countrywide on RTE Radio 1. Sponsored by Caller Gas, celebrating 80 years, bringing energy to Ireland's homes and businesses.
I'm here near Ahara in South County Roscommon, close to Loch Function, midway between Athlone and Roscommon town.
After a relatively dry conditions in January, the country has experienced more than twice the normal amount of rainfall per day during the first 18 days.
For farmers and householders dotted around this lake shore, the lake is overflowing. Land has been lost, livelihoods threatened, sheds destroyed, and households flooded.
We farmed on the edge of the lake, and I'm in my 83rd year now, and my father farmed before me.
Cullen Mee has farmed all his life in Lisflin, on the eastern side of the lake.
Down the years, when we got a few wet years in a row, it didn't go dry. But when the weather changed and you got drier summers, it eventually went dry and totally drained out. And when it came to a certain point, the base of the lake being so level, it disappeared in a night and it got the name of the Vanishing Lake. But what has happened since 16, too much water has got into it. This winter, the rain started in August and the lake started to fill, and there's no let up since August. And particularly since the 1st of February, there's been an inordinate amount of rain.
Hello, Barney. How are you keeping?
You're most welcome.
It's Thursday, and across the lake in Tulla, I'm in the kitchen of local county councillor and farmer Lawrence Fallon and his wife Bernie, where some of their neighbouring farmers have gathered to tell me more about how a once-in-a-100-year flooding has now happened this winter for the second time in 5 years.
So how many farms will be affected then?
45 anyway.
Would they? Yeah.
Well, it can be drained, but if it's not done, 120 hectares at a minimum would have to be compensated for. There's a huge loss here now, and it's making farms not viable. Every bird, every plant, and there was many rare plants in it, are now dead. And every tree around the lake, as you'll see when you go there, is dead as well.
I have down about 15 to 20 acres, I'd say, there at the moment now, and I had to turn around to either keep going. I rented land then as part of that to kind of keep going, to stay farming, to kind of get drier ground.
But I've seen around the lake for the last 4 years now, farmers who were never short of feed have been short because they've lost their 7 or 8 acres. They haven't got to reduce their number so much. So there's a lot of mental stress around the lake currently because people are on the edge. We're 7 or 8 acres down, so we're maybe 100 bales less than we should have.
The rain is getting heavier. That's how you get shown. It's a very, very heavy rain to what we got here to go on.
Yeah.
Plenty of flooding after then.
Ready we go. Half a mile down the road, Lawrence takes me to one of his neighbours, whose home was threatened by the overflowing lake.
This is Rory O'Mara. Rory and his wife and family live here.
Rory, how are you?
How are you?
And the house is currently surrounded by water on one.
Okay. So this is the water from the lake. When yes. did this flood arrive here?
Well, at this to this level, it's here probably about 4 or 5 days now at this level.
Right.
But it's been rising constantly for about the last week or 10 days.
It's only about 6 foot from your back door.
Yes, yeah, yeah.
How stressful is it?
We've no insurance now, so you know, we're going to probably have to pack up and leave here if this gets any worse. And this, the forecast that's envisaged in the next week or 10 days, could bring this to the level where the water will get in under the house.
The best of luck to you. It's hard to put into words.
Well, we're preparing to move now, so we are. We're making yeah. plans. So, yeah. so if we have to go, we have to go.
Well, I'm standing here just at the edge of the lake, and as you can hear how windy it is, it's a beautiful sight. But you would actually think, with the waves coming in, that you're beside an ocean rather than a lake. Those waves are creeping closer and closer to a lot of dwellings and a lot of farmhouses on the shoreline here.
Well, this is Tommy Carney, local Tommy. Farmer here on the lake, under severe pressure as well.
You're right on the edge of the lake here. We've come in behind the hedge because it's just too windy the other side, but
yes.
right across that ditch there, the water is coming right up and threatening this land here.
It's threatening this land, and it's totally blocked my roadway to the farm. It now means that I have to park my tractor, you can see it, up beside the bales, and I cannot use the tractor for any other purpose now other than just feeding the bales. I can't bring it down and I can't bring it up.
And if there's more rain, do you see this land then being flooded?
Yes.
Where we're standing now. We're 2 or 3 feet away now from where the waves are coming right into the ditch. And it's creeping in onto your land.
And you can see
I see your land further down the line.
Further down there is already quite a bit of it covered. It's reduced land for grazing, etc. But not alone that, it's the significant stress and wondering where is it going to stop? Is it going to be worse next year? Because I bet can't get to my shed now, or nobody can, I'm going to have to totally reconfigure the farm. And the traditionally we did sheep and suckler cows, but that's not viable anymore.
Yeah. And can you describe what this was like, 20, 30 years ago? We'll say on a summer's day.
On a summer's day here, 20, 30 years ago, you could stroll along here, and you'd have people who'd be in fishing, they'd be bird watching. Occasionally, you'd see the fish jumping for the flies. As a young fella, I was born 3 or 4 miles away from here, and I used to come visiting my uncle here who gave me the place. And I could never understand how we could live here at that time with the noise of the birds. Now,
All you hear is the flow of the water, listen.
All you hear is the water. It's a terrible stress. Thank you.
Yes, a terrible stress indeed. That's Roscommon farmer Tommy Carney there, worrying about his land being flooded by an overflowing lock function, along with a number of other farmers in that area. He was among a group of local residents and farmers I met on Thursday near Rahara, including local county councillor Lawrence Fallon, Colin Mee, Edward John Beattie, Anthony Beattie, Rory O'Mara and Gabriel O'Connor. Now, earlier this week, the National Potato Conference took place in Dublin. The number of commercial growers left in Ireland is continuing to decline because it's a challenging business, particularly due to the severe weather of recent years, be it drought or rain. Suzanne Campbell went along to hear about Borbia's efforts to get us eating more spuds, and she joins me in studio. Good morning, Suzanne.
Good morning.
First of all, tell us about this conference.
Yeah, the conference, it's a national conference that takes place between Borbia, IFA and potato growers and packers. And it took place on Tuesday. And there were a lot of experts there on crop varieties, sustainability, the nutrition of potatoes. And they really are a winner on this front. And of course, how Ireland can market and sell more potatoes. Now, we know that our potato consumption has declined, but sales at the moment are kind of steady. In 12% of all our shopping trips, we will buy potatoes. Okay. So that's good. But we're also buying smaller bags, not the big 4-stone bag you see your granny or your dad would have in the shed at the back or out the back kitchen.
Washed and microwavable in some cases.
Washed, microwavable, small varieties, smaller potatoes, under 2.5 kilograms. So they're now 41% of sales. And the shoppers that potato farmers and packers and the whole market really want are the under 35s because they've moved over to rice, to pasta, to quinoa, to couscous.
Quick fix.
Yes, yeah. It's instant. And they're the millennials and they want to attract them back to potatoes. So I spoke to Lorcan Burke, who's head of that department in Borbia, and he told me about the new EU-funded campaign, which has just begun, in tandem with Belgium and France, who are big potato producers as well. And it's focusing on these millennials, these 18 to 34-year-olds, trying to get them buying more potatoes and targeting them through their favourite thing, Damien, social media.
Millennials are a very distinct cohort of the total population. There'd be several subsectors within that, all with different needs. But the one thing we know they have in common is that they poorly understand the positive nutritional value of potatoes. Mm-hmm. And they tend to see potatoes as a very traditional sort of Irish sort of big meal product. They love the taste of them. That's clearly established across all our research. But I guess their view of a meal is something that takes 15 to 20 minutes. Mm-hmm. And we have to put before them the recipes, the ideas and the tips of how to cook potatoes, which can have all the health virtues in the world, but if they don't have the convenience, they won't have relevance for this particular audience. The key to this particular campaign will be social media, because that's where we know the millennials are. and we need to target them on that social media and give them the recipes to empower them to cook the food and then change these attitudes by just filling in sort of gaps in their information that they don't have around nutrition, that they're fat-free, that they're gluten-free, that they're packed with dietary fibre. These are all things that millennials tell us in Bord Bia through the market research that they want to know about them. They also want to know about the sustainability credentials of potatoes, which are far superior than pasta and particular rice. So potatoes are on message for millennials, but they just haven't actually made the connection that they're a very natural, sustainable and nutritious food.
Now, we heard at the conference as well, the IFA president, Tim Cullinan, speaking about potato farmers in the same way that every other farmer is spoken about, and that is that they are the poor relation, and that in 2019 it was the second lowest year on record for planting of spuds. Is that right?
Yeah, less potatoes are being planted, less varieties, and we're also importing a lot of those small potatoes, which is really hurting farmers here. But I met after the conference with one farmer and his brother who've decided to do something completely different with their potatoes. The Clinton family, it's a well-known name in North Dublin Meath. They've been farming and growing potatoes there for seven generations, but because of the volatility in price, Martin and his brother Sean decided to go into making crisps, really good crisps. I first talked to Martin, who's growing and supplying the potatoes to his brother Sean, and it was Sean's idea to direct those potatoes into crisps rather than onto the fresh potato market, which they were doing. I began by asking Martin if he grew the different varieties of potatoes for his brother's crisp enterprise, so different to what you buy in the shops.
Yes, different varieties, Lady Rosetta, Amarillo and some Kibitz specifically for making crisps. You wouldn't buy them off the supermarket shelf.
And how did you feel about getting involved in this business from growing food in the traditional sense, supplying it to the marketplace? Obviously, price, weather, there's an awful lot of challenges in potatoes recently. Was this a new set of challenges, or you thought this might be a solution to being a price taker?
Originally, yeah, when Sean mooted the idea of let's go and get Chris, I went, no. No, I don't want to get into that. No, definitely not. But then we sat down, we had a chat. He showed me figures and how the whole marketplace was with this luxury type crisp. And we had a look at it and we said, yeah, let's go for it. I suppose we sell a lot of potatoes wholesale and your price fluctuation is up and down and up and down. And if there's a plentiful supply in the year, your price is very, very low. So your margin is extremely low. Going forward, I have a son that's interested in farming and maybe this is some type of foundation. So if we can build on this and what we'd end up doing is growing our own potatoes, all whatever we ever grow and goes into the crisps, that's a great foundation to send on to the next generation. So that's basically what I'm trying to do on the farming end of it.
Because I know from being at the conference, there's an awful lot of discontent about price and the supermarkets taking such big margins and growers feeling that they've so little power in the chain.
Yeah, there's a big margin between what the actual grower actually gets for his end product and what the customer actually pays. And especially on the wholesale market as well, like, you know, it's even less than that, like, you know. So this is my way of trying to do something to continue the farming for the Clintons within the Skerries area.
So the crisp market, now I have a pack of these.
Give me some.
In front of me. Oh, they're so good. They're more crispy than your normal crisp. They're thicker and they've absolutely masses of flavour. Now, the crisp market in Ireland's really interesting. We're kind of obsessed about crisps, but there's only three crisp factories. Largo, what was Largo, who make Tato and Hunky Dory's and other brands in Mead, that's now owned by a German company, Intersnack.
Right. Yeah.
And then Kyo's Crisps have a factory. And now this new little crisp factory, which I visited, the Clinton's Crisps in Ashbourne. If you look at the marketplace, a pack of Tato is about €1.05 and a packet of those is only about €1.30. So it's actually very good value for a handmade product. Sean Martin's brother worked for Tato for years.
Lovely.
But he wanted to do something different to the mass market. This means that all the potatoes Martin delivers from the farm, they're weighed, they're measured for water content and they're cooked according to this, unlike the big factories which just throughput the whole lot. And that's why they taste very different. So I asked Sean about this process.
It is different. We look at the potato, what we have in store, and when it comes in, we do all the tests, how much solids are in, how much water is in it, and what size they are, what amount of peel is on. And from that, we determine how we cook to our end product that we want. So we change all those parameters, which is batch size, which is slice thickness, which is temperature, etc., to give it that unique texture, the crunch, individual crisp eating, and the flavouring then will be adjusted accordingly. We've seen that crisps were heading towards that mass-produced product. We want to bring it back to how crisps used to be. There are only three ingredients, which is obviously potato, oil and flavour, but they are very inherent in the Irish psyche. Everybody in Ireland likes crisps, and what we're trying to do is make a crisp that everybody can eat. Hence, we made it obviously vegan-friendly, it's gluten-free, it's vegetarian-friendly, and obviously the flavour flavours, we're trying to get the flavours we made or trying to bring us back to what we remember. It's like sort of salt and vinegar is very much of scary beside the sea, eating a bag of chips, you know, and the sun is shining, that kind of element. So it's trying to bring all that heritage we have, all the family attributes we have, and bring that into a product that we're very, very proud of.
What has it been like coming from working in a big crisp factory in the industry, having a family farm, producing potatoes, and then starting your own business? What's that been like?
It can be very lonely.
And stressful, I'd say.
Yeah, stressful as well. It can be that, but we've had a lot of help, obviously, from like sort of Enterprise Ireland, the Food Academy and Super Value, and a lot of other people and family and friends. Myself and my brother's wife do a lot of tastings for us. Obviously, our sons as well, they help in the factory as much as they can as well. So it's been a very family project, and we want to keep that end of us. Like, we're seven-generation farming. We're very proud of where we come from in Skerries, and we'd like to keep that tradition going and then transpose it into, obviously, making the best crisps that we can.
And that's Sean Clinton there, and the very best of luck to them with that new business. Thanks for that, Suzanne. Will you stay with us? We're going to have a discussion after the break, which I think you'll be very interested in. Now, the first ever National Library Open Day takes place next Saturday, and you're invited to visit your local library and take a closer look at all it has to offer. Now, today's libraries are pretty unrecognisable from the libraries of the past as they adapt to changing times and people's different habits. Now, Brenda Donoghue visited a very busy Dungarvan Library in County Waterford this week. And outside it, she first met with Liz Cluxton, who was using their Borrow Box service.
I was the youngest child in the school by 2 years, and I spoke only English.
Well, Brenda, I'm listening to The Power of One by Bryce Courtenay. And I love this book because the voices, the chap who's reading this, and I just feel transported.
This book comes from the Borrow Box service
in
the library.
In the library, you go, yes.
Explain it, what does it mean to you?
Okay, what it means for me is I download the app and then I've got a choice of hundreds of books that speak to me. I don't have to read them. So if I'm walking, I can have my earphones in and I can get my story. Or if I'm on a bus, I'm entertained all the way, and it's fantastic. It transports me. Different countries, different times, different history.
Voilà les fiches, voilà bibliothèque.
Ouais.
On est bientôt arrivé.
Ouais.
Ouais. Des nouveaux choix.
Okay, let's go. We go off to the library now.
Okay.
Get your bags. We're going to borrow some books.
Clotilde Kiley, originally from France, and her two daughters, Eloise and Juliet, are en route to borrow some books.
The girls love their books. That's probably one of their favourite activities. So we come here quite regularly. But we come here to borrow books. We borrow music also. And we attend some events that the library is running regularly.
Eloise, how old are you?
8 years old.
What do you like about the library?
Because when you're looking at books, you invent a story in your head and you can make pictures of it.
Have you decided what you're going to take out?
I'm going to take this book called Not Lost.
Hello, girls. How are you today?
Good.
I'll take these books out to you now straight away. See you later.
Okay.
See you next week.
Thank you.
Bye. That's Tracy McEnany, executive librarian with Waterford Libraries, helping the children there. She loves her job.
Well, I came for work experience about 25 years ago and I never left. And it's just a really great place to work. Every day is totally different. Like, the people, every person in this library today has a story. And we love hearing all about the stories. And it's a real community space. We hear about the births, the deaths, the marriages, the good times, the bad times. And we feel we're kind of very much at the heart of the community. And it's a great privilege.
I'm looking at your library space here. And it's so different to what I remember a library being. We've got a children's library, we've a self-service section, we have a reading area, and it goes on and on and on. So is it very challenging to keep libraries relevant in this day and age?
Absolutely, because there is so many other activities that are going on outside the library that we want to try and get as many people in And this is what our national campaign is all about. Take a closer look at your library. We, at the moment, 16% of the population are members of the library, and we want to increase it by up to 30% by 2022. But we're bringing in now, here in this library, you're going to have a magic table, which will help people with dementia, and it'll help people with autism as well. And we'll also have more laptops as well. So that means that people can use the laptop anywhere here in the library. And it's just keeping it relevant all the time. And we're changing with the changes that are happening outside the library will happen inside the library. There's just so much going on. It's a real vibrant space. It's just there's something in this library for absolutely everyone. Okay, children, are we all okay? Listening, looking up here. So today we're going to be using our Lego to make stories. We're going to have characters, we're going to think of a setting, and at the very end we're going to think of a title, because sometimes when you start, you're not too sure what you're going to start. Would that be right, what the story's going to be about? Yeah. Would that be the way?
The third class pupils from Skulwera in Abbeyside in Dungarvan are at a literacy through Lego workshop in the children's section of the library. Janet Twigg, who is the reader in residence, explains to me what it's all about.
So it's really, I suppose, for everybody, and it's that everybody is able to join in, because sometimes we have children in our classes and writing is difficult and putting things together is difficult. And so this is just another way and another medium, and it's including everybody, and it's children whose English may not be as good as some of the other children, and some of the children who are more vulnerable, they really enjoy it. And children from all different backgrounds really, really enjoy it. And at the end, what happens is that when they've made their construction, then they talk about their story. And everybody listens, and they all get a clap, and everybody's story is as important as everybody else's.
I have to get down on the ground here to meet the next this person. What's your name?
Zara Byrne.
Okay, what are you making?
We made a beach house for people that want to go out on the beach. They can get sandals and take a shower after surfing and stuff.
Well, from some of the younger library users to some of the older ones, Jackie Stanford is 78 years old and left school at 14 and struggled with reading and writing.
Well, first of all, I would say I don't have a problem about leaving school at 14. It was common amongst working class families. The oldest had to go out and bring in a few bob. I'd help rear the rest of the family. But I got an apprenticeship like it was a family trade, you know, like. But I always liked reading. I liked English. In the winter of 1956, with dark evenings, a very little work around and no bobs to go to the pictures, I decided to join. I found what were known then as the detective stories, thrillers now, I suppose. And I remember reading Edgar Wallace, which drew you into the mucky world of horse racing. It brought me into a different world, really, you know.
What do you remember about the library then at 14?
At the library was at the top of Friary Street and run with quite efficiency by two middle-aged ladies named Clancy. I'm grateful for the effect that the two old ladies allowed me to take out books in my parents' tickets, you know, so I really enjoyed that. It had a big contributory factor in my life.
And Jackie, if I can kind of jump along a lot, at 65 you're retired.
Yeah.
And what did you go and do?
I did an arts degree in history and politics at UCC. And at the library there, expanded my knowledge. It gave me an articulation of my own views. I didn't change my own views, but I was better able to articulate them, I think, you know.
Jackie, if you look back at the decades you've been a library member, what does it mean to you?
It's been a constant influence and an enjoyment, and it has given me a lot of happiness and knowledge. I never worked out for them, but it brought me to those places in my own mind. Where would you be without it?
Well, that was 78-year-old Jackie Sandford, ending Brenda Donoghue's report from Dungarvan Library. And remember, the first ever National Library Open Day is next Saturday. Now, government policy says that the future of driving is electric, and the target is to have 1 million electric cars on Irish roads within a decade. Right now, there are just 9,000 electric cars on the road out of over 2 million. But just how feasible is the electric car for the longer commutes and for rural driving? Well, George Lee, RTÉ's environment and science correspondent, has been driving electric cars for many's the year now. Amy McKeever of Irish Country Living magazine has driven one for a week. And Suzanne Campbell, who's just purchased a hybrid, is with me here in studio. You're all very welcome. Amy, first to you, how did you get on?
Damien, look, I suppose the bottom line is we'd like this to work. I went to the IFA Smart Farming event in Kilkenny and met with the company who gave me this car, 3CEA in Kilkenny. They're an energy company. They want this to work, but they had identified issues in terms of trying to be a commuter and trying to get into Dublin or into any city. Yeah. You know what I mean? Now, my commute is long, but there are plenty of people that are commuting from Portlaoise, from Navan, from, you know what I mean, Wicklow. Yeah. Mine might be slightly longer than other people's, but this is a common Brilliant. Problem in rural Ireland.
And you'd be saving, you know, hundreds of euro a month on diesel, for example. So you have this
huge for our family, do you know what I mean, to try to save it.
And you'd be reducing your carbon footprint as well. So how did you get on? You're driving from home in Kilkenny up to the Farmers Journal on the Naas Road 4 or 5 days a week. How did you get on?
So I started off, I suppose, on the first day and, you know, completely naive to this. Never had one of these before. Got into the car and the first thing the girl said to me was, you need to turn off the heater because you won't get to Dublin with the heater on. So okay. This was a bit of a wake-up call that, you know what I mean, first of all, I was going to have to drive to Dublin in the freezing cold. I started driving it. I was trying to work out what pace to go at and the battery was going down and down and down, and then I started to freak out a little bit that I actually wasn't going to make it to Dublin at all. I pulled in at the new petrol station, said I'd charge it up. The company had given me a card and everything. I thought this was going to be easy. Neither one of the chargers worked. So a guy in an Audi pulled in. He went, oh, they're not working. Get used to it. And he drove off. I was like, okay, what am I going to do? I rang the company. They said, try Naas. Drove up to Tesco and Naas. That didn't work either. So I limped into the office then at about 30 miles an hour, ringing the person I was supposed to meet in town, saying, I'm going to be really late. I'm really sorry.
Yeah.
Arrived into the office and there was a car parked in the one place where I could charge the car. Got onto the management of the building. Can you move this car? That person comes down, says, sorry, I'll move the car. And this went on for the week.
And then you had a sick child as well. Yes.
So on Saturday, I suppose, really, it came home to us. Now, I was very adamant we were going to do this for the week. You know what I mean? It was for the paper. I wanted to do it for the week and see how we got on. But on Saturday morning, fever, cough, cold, 6-year-old needs to go to the doctor and take her into the care doc in Kilkenny. She could get sent down to Waterford to the paediatric unit down there. And I just said, no.
You're not taking a chance because you didn't think there was
That's it. You know what I mean? That's the line that we won't cross. Into the diesel and into Kilkenny to the doctors. And she was fine, but, and we would have made it, but it's that fear that you're not going
to. And you drove around all week with a hat on and coat and everything because you didn't want to put on the heater.
A water bottle in my lap.
George, you've your hands in your head there. Is this a common experience for newbies driving electric cars?
I mean, it's just crazy the kind of commute that she was doing in a car that she didn't know with no experience and learning on the job like that. It's not a normal commute. The average commute, according to CSO, the typical commuter in the census of population last time drives within 28, 29 minutes to work, and secondly lives within 15 kilometres. She's driving from Kilkenny to Dublin and from Kilkenny to Mullingar and saying that this is normal for an electric car driver. It's not.
Well, then what's the point of an electric car? Because in Dublin, in the urban areas where you're doing small commutes, we have trains, we have buses, but in the countryside where there isn't public transport and you have to drive everywhere.
What's wrong with a plug-in hybrid? She wouldn't have had any difficulty.
She's sitting beside you, by the way, George.
Well, I mean, so my point is, it's a headbanger experiment to do what she did with no experience whatsoever and then tell everybody that's the experience with electric cars. It's not. Most people who drive them have very positive experiences. People who review them, who aren't used to them, always write negative stuff.
Amy.
Well, I would suggest, like, the commentary that I got back when I was driving the car over the course of the week, and yes, it is, my commute is long. I'm not taking away
long.
From that.
Long, it's extraordinary long. 10% of the people in the sense of population, only 10, that's 1 in 10, commute more than an hour. You do much more than that.
Mine is approximately an hour and a half. But what I'm saying is there are people that have shorter commutes than me who would still struggle with an electric car. Like I've said, I want this to work, but it's the infrastructure is not there to make this happen.
That's true.
And you know what I mean? And we're talking about rural Ireland here. We're talking about trying to make something work for rural Ireland.
But most people in rural Ireland don't drive what you drive either.
I would argue that doesn't. If diesel and petrol cars are going to be taken off the road and that there's a drive towards this, what I would like to see is that the infrastructure would be put in place. Like farmers, if one partner in a farm family is living and has to, and the other partner has to work off farm to support the farm income and they have to drive to that job, they can't exactly pick where they go.
But what are the benefits then, George? And then I bring Susanna.
Like Amy's just said about where people have two cars, where one of them, in most cases, at least could be an electric car because the flexibility and the ability, one car generally in a household is a runaround car more than another. They don't do the long commutes. The savings are absolutely enormous. The drive is much better. The insurance is cheaper. The maintenance costs are cheaper. And with flexibility, like if I were going anywhere for work, I would not bring my electric car. Amy's nuts for what she did.
Yeah, but
because you're under too much pressure. And the savings are so significant for families. Amy's experience and what she's saying about electric car is true for somebody who wants to commute for an hour and a half. For most people, they really should consider at least having one in the household.
I think it's a really interesting experience that Amy had, and I would identify with that in terms of the audience that's listening to this that is rural. And we have a spread of people who listen to this programme. They're often very urban or suburban based like George, or they're often very rurally based like Amy. I'm interesting because I'm kind of between the two. I'm 30 kilometres from Dublin. I bought a hybrid car this week, which
that's a plug-in hybrid.
So it's a Mitsubishi. It's a four-wheel drive. I deal with a lot of snow and ice in the winter. I also tow animals. Mm. Won't tow more than 1.5 tons. This was a family car. So we had a very old Volvo that was letting in rain, that was freezing. I drive around with a hot water bottle in my Volvo. It had to go. So this week, we bought this car secondhand. I sat into it for the first time yesterday. I drove to RTE all on the battery. And I will drive home all on the battery, 35k. So that's about.
But you see, this is.
Plug it in here. Yeah. And then if I go to Mullingar, or I do huge mileage. My last Volvo had 350,000 miles in it. I do huge mileage. When I get out into the countryside on motorway, I'll drive on the petrol engine. But if I park it in Apple Green or anywhere else, I expect to charge it. And basically, my neighbour has this exact same car. Two of my friends do. And this is why I bought it, because I like to see real people's experience, rurally based. Their bills went from putting about 70 into their diesel every week to putting 40 a month into this. Well, but the solution, I think, for rural people is a bit of both for the moment. Until that technology gets further ranges and until the infrastructure improves an awful lot, I think you need the petrol engine or something to supply you with that extra mileage.
And I think, George, you know what I mean? We mentioned, you know what I mean? I was new to this. You know what I mean? Yeah. I was trying to adjust
You're learning very
but
fast.
The etiquette around the use of these chargers is kind of like a re-education of drivers as well. Mm. Because, you know what I mean? I went and one of the nights I was staying in, over in the Crow Park Hotel, and I sat in the car park, I waited for the guy to finish. He pulled out. I'm reversing out. Somebody else pulls in. I waited. He went off. He never came back. I came down the following morning and his car was still sitting plugged in.
Did you have a parking or a charging point put in at home for this experiment?
No, but I charged mine overnight. Once I got home, there was no problem. Like I had 12 hours there.
Well, so George, what you're saying, there's an awful lot of planning goes into it. For a family now, we're into the new year. They might be wanting to change their 10-year-old car. Mm. What should they be...
Well, look, I wouldn't go preaching to anybody what they should do because I know everybody's situation is different.
Yeah.
But I would say to people who have two car families and some of them are not in these very far out rural areas that consider an electric vehicle for one of those cars and swap around between you because the savings are enormous.
And you found
savings. I agree with that. Like I have friends who, like, you know what I mean, one of them is commuting a distance and one of them is a teacher and might be teaching in the local village and they have two cars. Like George's experience, you know what I mean, the electric car goes to the school and it doesn't have to be charged up because in a lot of places there just isn't somewhere in rural Ireland to charge the car.
All right.
A lot of people got in contact with me saying what George is saying, you know, got the wrong car. There is a car that has a greater range for me. But
The lesson for us all is a learning curve and we've a long way to go. And finally, final question to you, George. A million electric cars on Irish roads by 2030. Who's going to build them?
Well, I don't know who's going to build them.
Whatever about who's going to buy them.
But the argument is that the running costs and the cost of ownership is coming down very rapidly. And that and at the same time, the government is going to be putting up the running costs and the cost of ownership of petrol and diesel by increasing carbon taxes and everything else. So that by the middle of the decade, it will be much cheaper for people to make the decision to buy it. There's that combined with the prices coming down internationally. And they just feel that a tipping point will happen. This is what the department and so on will tell you. A tipping point will happen in the middle of the decade whereby everybody will begin to rush to buy them. So they think, and that combined with rolling out the infrastructure and all of the incentives which are there, you know, you get reductions on your tolls, you get all sorts of reductions in terms of the
cost.
Your
tax is only 170 on mine and it's a 2 litre petrol.
Mine is 120 because it's 100% electric.
That's pretty good.
So they feel that that will change the whole environment.
Right.
Now, I think that might be wishful thinking. I think the infrastructure is a huge issue. I think you've heard it here from Amy and it's for real, but it is rolling out. But the promises are there. The learning curve we all have to go on, and the experiences, everybody's one is a little bit different. I know it's about rural commuting and so on, but for urban commuters, they're mad not to think about this.
Okay, all right. And Amy, as you said, you will try it again. Listen, thank you all very much. It's a discussion we will come back to. Thank you very much, Amy, for joining us. George, for dropping in. And Suzanne, the best of luck with your new hybrid as well.
Yeah.
Okay, all right. Well, later tonight on TG Cahir, the annual Gradam Keol Awards for traditional Irish music will be broadcast from the Waterfront Hall in Belfast. And there, Ned Kelly, who's a Tipperary farmer and musician, will receive a Gradam Comhdhéine for his contribution to traditional music. Ned is an accordion player and founder of a local trad orchestra for young people. This week, he's trying to juggle the music with the reality of being a farmer during the busy calving season, as he explained to Brian Lally.
In the townland of Ballycommon, just outside Nina, lives Ned Kelly. Ned is a beef and dairy farmer, but he's also a noted box player. And this very night, he's in Belfast to receive the TG Cahir Gradam Keol Award.
And meeting Ned in his farmyard,
you get the feeling he wishes that he was getting this award any other weekend but this one.
At the minute, we're right bang in the middle of calving, as I said, with the cattle end of it. What you're looking at the minute, there's about maybe 75 calved so far. The rest of them then are waiting. There's some of them there behind you.
From here to maternity.
There's about 15 of them in there now. Within 24 or 36 hours of popping, we just tend to move them into straw bedding within maybe a few days of calving, just to make this. We've cameras there in the shed, so just keep an eye on them 24/7. You know, it's great because you don't have to get up in the middle of the night to come down. Then maybe a windy night like this, you come down to have a 5 minute look, and all of a sudden you're wide awake and it's hard to get back to sleep. So, and as I said with the award, something to really look forward to, but at the same time there's been so much work going on at the minute, it doesn't you won't sink in till we actually arrive in Belfast.
Maybe it's spending time with a fairly significant collection of accordions, as well as a host of young musicians, that keeps Ned Kelly grounded and gives him a bit of relief from the difficulties of agriculture.
There's massive work attached to the dairy and the things. Still, it's probably at the minute, it is probably the most stable income that's in farming. If you like being at the cows, well then, you know, if you like all the work associated with it, then it can be a very enjoyable job. If you don't, then dairying definitely isn't for you. If you're not willing to be committed to something, the beef end of things, I don't really think it can be justified how we're being paid such a bad price at the minute. Look, you want to be able to pay your way, but I just think farmers aren't getting a fair deal with the beef thing at the minute, definitely not.
Well, listen, we'll get out of the cold for a while and we'll talk about music and we'll talk about accordions, and we're going to meet a couple of people that you've been playing with and teaching with for a while.
The idea of the orchestra, we've set up to do one fundraising concert for the Donald Walsh Foundation. That was the end of the orchestra. But the teenagers came together and they had signed this big petition saying they wanted it to continue. They're up in the house now. We'll sit down, have a cup of tea and a chat, and we're going to play a few tunes maybe for you as well, and just see how it goes.
Let's take the trip.
And up in the house, there's seven or eight of his young charges, with borons, accordions, a keyboard, flutes and whistles. I have a feeling this is going to be a pleasant evening.
I was asked, I suppose, when I was... I suppose maybe 8 or 9, 10 years of age, would I like to play music? So obviously I said I'd love to play music. I remember getting this accordion off Santa, and my parents couldn't wait for me to open the box at Christmas morning, and I caught it and I threw it against the wall and I said, "You don't understand, I don't want a Thai one, it's a real one I want." So I started into music when I was probably 10 or 11 years of age. You don't get good at music or get good at anything, really. You have to put in, it's like the 10,000 hour theory. And I did work at it hard. I've been very lucky along the way. You know, without music, I really don't know where I'd be now.
Well, I'm fairly sure you wouldn't be in the front room of your house of a Monday evening with a gang like this. Have a listen. Some of the members of the orchestra told me of unexpected benefits particularly for young people.
And coming into it, I would have been a fairly shy young lad. I would have been 10. And sure, over the years then, you would have met the lads. You would have talked to them every Sunday, day in, day out. It means a lot from the point of view of social life and that. Came out with Michelle a lot with the orchestra.
I started music when I was in primary school, actually, with Ned. Continued on then I started lessons, playing the accordion with Ned in Lisna Hall. So that's how it all started then, and then the orchestra. So it all just followed on bit by bit.
And what about your man? Is he a good teacher?
Oh, sure, we can't say anything bad about him today. No, he's brilliant. Sure, only for Ned, we wouldn't have anything. Everyone can talk to anyone. Do you know, in this day and age of mental health and everything, we all feel like we're one family and we can all talk to one another. And if you have a problem, do you know, it's actually so united. I speak about the orchestra, but about everyone. Such a united group. Talk to anybody. Do you know, Ned is like a daddy to us all, really, at the end of the day. Honest to God, I'd go to him if I had any problem tomorrow morning. Yeah. Do you know, we're all just so united, one big family, and that's so important. And that's one thing I can say about the orchestra.
You can go to your flares, you can play us, you might not play us. At the end of the day, you still have the orchestra.
You know, we've done a lot of different stuff. We've done lately quite a few concerts for, for autism units in schools. We've done a good bit of stuff for the Donald Walsh Foundation. We've done stuff for the Heart Foundation, North Tape Hospice. I think we've raised up near over 60,000 for the local hospice. We've an amazing crew of almost 70 in the orchestra. It's like everything in life. There's several along the way that haven't bought into it, and there's several who couldn't commit. We've no problem with that.
This is about 7 o'clock on a Monday evening, with one recorder, the musicians around me in a semicircle. Terrific stuff.
When they come to our practice, that's it, lads. Get rid of the phones. If you want to communicate, just talk to each other and sit down and play music and keep it as simple as you can, you know. It's a form of expression as well. Coming and going, there's probably been up to 170, 180 teenagers, maybe more involved. And what we have now, some of them have been there 6 years, some of them have only been there maybe 5 or 6 months. Some of them kids that, you know, like any big group of teenagers, you'd know kids that have had problems or whatever. But the one thing is, when they play music, whether they're All-Ireland Fly winners or whether they're just kids that work away hard at music, it doesn't matter. When you're in an orchestra, you're part of a group, and it's not there for any particular individual to shine out. It's just there for everybody to row in together. It works well, and at the end of the day, I think it's a great learner for kids as well, because, I mean, you know, if you're in this, you have to commit to it, and that in itself, I think, is a good thing, you know.
That was Ned Kelly and some of the young musicians from the Ballycommon area, and you can see Ned getting his award at the Gradon Keogh Awards tonight, 9:30, TG Cahir.